now. Okay, evolution. Big questions about evolution are things like, what is it? What is it? Evolution's a change in allele frequency over time. That's the very specific thing. You need to think back in terms of DNA about what an allele is as well. So an allele is just different DNA sequence. So there's a whole bunch of different potential alleles for every protein you possibly get. And what we're saying with evolution is that something happens to change the frequency of them in a population as time goes by. You probably even know the answer to why that is. Things live and die for genetic reasons. We had a little bit more from my favourite eccentric geneticist, Steve Jones. Things live, die, or reproduce better for genetic reasons. So, sometimes it's really hard to work out what that might be, but that's the essence of evolution. It's what, nature read of tooth and claw. Nature will kill things, or things will just die, because they're not quite as good at something as something else is. And we've talked about that with human evolution examples. Why did we exist, and Neanderthals, who are better adapted to the cold, stronger, bigger brains, reasonable toolkit, living in Europe and stuff beforehand, die out, and us, lighter, smaller brain, less well adapted to the cold, survive? And the answer at some level is that there's a genetic reason for it. What that genetic reason is, we don't know, because Neanderthal genomes haven't been sequenced a huge amount. The outworking of that kind of evolution thing eventually leads to new species. And the whole difficulty we have with understanding how species come about is misconception number one. Organisms adapt themselves to their environment. There's only one kind of organism that adapts itself to its environment. Well, no, we don't. I was going to say it's us, but we adapt our environment to us. If we don't like trees, we cut them down. If they keep growing back, we concrete over the top. So we adapt to the environment. But animals don't adapt to the environment. Animals got a variety of different genes present in their gene pool, and the environment changes. Some live, some die. The ones that live, their genes get carried on, and that's the lesson of stuff like the Darwin Awards. You remove yourself from the gene pool for acts of extreme stupidity. You put your head on the rails to hear if the train's coming, and you're facing the wrong way. The train was coming. You're removed from the gene pool. The guy who tried to open a hand grenade with a chainsaw removed himself from the gene pool. So acts of extreme stupidity. So, we've got the gene pool. There's pressures on it because people live and die all the time. What makes something turn into a new species? So, what's the definition of a species? You can try definition of a species. Definition of a species: group of animals living in the same place that can and do reproduce and produce fertile offspring. That's a species. Dogs, all one species. Because at some point you can always encourage dogs of various breeds. Well, Chihuahua males don't take much encouraging. They'll try to reproduce with any female dog. And they're very, very persistent at it. They're the same breed. Humans, anything that we can perceive as sort of like racial differences, don't exist. The only things that prevent humans from breeding is opportunity. Humans will travel to new and interesting places, find new and interesting animals and develop recipes for them, find people living there and attempt to reproduce with them. There's famous bits in English history, and the Mutiny on the Bounty is one of the famous things, the founding of Pitcairn Island. People in Polynesia were very aware of the dangers of inbreeding, so when new people arrived, they got given the youngest, most nubile females, and British sailors found that to be a really, really incredible sort of state of affairs for them, and didn't want to leave. So nasty captain makes them leave, they throw nasty captain in a boat and make him go away, and try to find the island again. They found Pitcairn instead. Okay, so evolution, change in the frequency of alleles in a gene pool. The end point of evolution is you end up with a new species. Now, we talked about humans not being species, dogs being like one species. What would make something into a new species? It's when they can't interbreed. So, if we said a group of organisms living in the same place that can and do reproduce and produce fertile offspring, each one of those things we can stop and have a look at. Same place. If you end up in different places, reproduction doesn't happen. For humans at the moment, travel means that that's never a barrier. But we talk about things called reproductive isolation, or barriers to reproduction. And if we're a lot smaller or a lot less ingenious, barriers to reproduction are river changes course. Or if we watch The Land Before Time, earthquake covers the way to the Great Valley. It was a while since I'd seen it. Mountain building, ice ages change it. Ice ages did a couple of things. When there's lots of ice, when there's lots of water locked up in ice, sea levels all drop and things can move backwards and forwards. We get humans travelling, humans and a whole lot of other big animals travelling to North America across the Bering Land Bridge. We get what's called Wallace's Line in Indonesia, where there's a line where when the sea levels dropped, animals from Asia came down the down through the Southeast Asian Peninsula and stuff, down through Malaysia and into the islands about as far as Sulawesi and New Guinea. Islands from New Guinea across, there's obviously a deep water channel, and the animals didn't get there, and they're all Australian. The other ones are all Asian. So, something has to happen to a group of organisms to make a new species. Simplest one, they get geographically isolated. Birds that got blown from Australia to New Zealand didn't get to fly back. So the population living in New Zealand had a different set of selection pressures. New Zealand's colder, New Zealand doesn't have vertebrate predators, New Zealand's got a lot more forest, wetter, all that sort of stuff, and you get variations. Well-known variations like kiwi being Australian birds. The other kind of reproductive isolation is the things that stop you reproducing that aren't in a different place. So they can be, you suddenly start getting up at night. There was a story about a man who decided that worked the night shift for 20 years and was asked, you know, why are you working the night shift? And he said, well, I hated the management, but I loved the job. So if I work at night, I never have to meet the managers. They just leave me notes. But if you're working night shift, reproductive opportunity with someone who's... So if you're working the night shift, you're nocturnal. Reproductive opportunities with someone who works the day shift are minimal. Diurnal, nocturnal. If you suddenly become nocturnal, it produces a barrier to potential reproduction. There are behavioural ones, structural ones. Now, those of you who've seen that How Animals Have Sex book, we'll see, but it's that insects have really, really specifically shaped reproductive parts, and they fit together like locks and keys, and the bizarre bean weevil penis will obviously only fit in a female bean weevil because nothing else could be that shape. That's a structural barrier. Behavioural ones will start developing a new courtship song in a particular area that other kinds of things don't recognise. In humans, it manifests itself as language, although language doesn't ever appear to have been a reproductive barrier in humans. But for some animals, that kind of courtship is really, really important. In birds, that whole ritualised courtship is really, really important. And I think we've talked about it back when we did courtship. What's important about a courtship ritual? It checks that the individual is the right species because it understands the signals. It's the right gender because it understands the signals. Sexually mature. And all that sort of thing is important if you're going to get to reproduce successfully. So, the barriers are either geographical or, a whole lot of other series like Time, you decide to live in a different environment, ecological, behavioural, structural. The last one that we can talk about again is what happens if you suddenly change your number of chromosomes. Plants do it much more than animals. Animals aren't. For animals, number of chromosomes is really, really sensitive. For plants, suddenly doubling your number of chromosomes seems to have been potentially possible. It's called polyploidy. If you suddenly have the wrong number of chromosomes, you can't reproduce successfully with things of the same species as your parents. Polyploidy is a thing called instant speciation. That's a dodgy one too, because in humans, beg your pardon, in plants, wheat, our ordinary flower wheat, is hexaploid. There's six copies of each chromosome. And it's also been done to build things as into the bigger and bigger fruit that we get to see too. Okay, so if you become reproductively isolated, you don't reproduce with another population. You get more different because selection pressures act differently on you, and you can end up becoming a new species. Three kinds of speciation. One, the geographic separation thing. That's called allopatric speciation. If you want to remember allopatric speciation, you know, if you suddenly living on an ice floe, one of them breaks off, we have to go, hello, Patrick, far away. Allopatric speciation is geographical. Sympatric speciation is when you become another species for some of the, one of those other reasons. Occupy a different ecological niche, do a different time scale, change your behaviour, get some kind of structural change that stops that. So that's sympatric speciation. Polyploidy, you suddenly change your number of chromosomes, that's called instant speciation. So that's the sort of thing that forms species. Now, in New Zealand, this shows up in a whole lot of ways because New Zealand's got a couple of things that happen to it. First, New Zealand broke away from Gondwana about 80 million years ago. Date significant. Why is the date significant? Okay, that's the thing about mammals. Dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. The rise of mammals happened after that. So New Zealand broke away before the rise of mammals. So you find dinosaur fossils here, but our only mammals are two really small bats. And they, almost everything that ended up in New Zealand appears to have blown here. Either blown here or arrived on rafting vegetation. There was a theory at one point called the Moa's Ark theory that everything came here, like everything was here, New Zealand broke away 80 million years ago, and everything that was on New Zealand evolved in New Zealand. DNA studies have suggested that's not true. That Kiwis, for example, are much, much more recent. Our iconic things like our silver fern is Australian. Australia, because it's upwind of us. So stuff comes here from Australia, it doesn't come here from Chile. Because we're in the westerly wind thing. So in New Zealand, we've broken away, we get things from Australia and they arrive somewhere new. Arriving somewhere new, all the ecological niches are available to you. And this, whole lots of ecological niches can get occupied, and each one of them has a different set of pressures. If you're a bird, you suddenly blow here from Australia, you land, you go, oh no, it's really cold and really lots of trees and it's wet. But there's a whole lot of places that birds live that you basically get the choice of. And what happens is every time there's a space, something moved into that ecological niche. New Zealand parrots are an example. We've got like weirdest parrots in the world. Everywhere else in the world, parrots are colourful, raucous, fly really badly, and sort of eat fruit and nectar and stuff. They don't live in the mountains and are green. They don't live in sub-Antarctic islands in big flocks. They don't live in the mountains at night and don't fly. The kaka, you know, big parrot, eats nectar, but it's not colourful and it's not social. Most parrots are really, really social. New Zealand's got smaller ones as well. We've got, our parrots are related to the parrots around the Pacific. And you can look and say, you know, there's Chatham Islands, Norfolk Island, North and South Island have all got something in common. They're all downwind of Australia. So an ancestral parrot arrives in one of those places, gets a series of different selection pressures, you die for different genetic reasons, and you end up in what we see today. Kia, kaka, kakariki, of however many different kinds of kakariki we want to talk about. Kakapo. Kakapo is the weirdest. Too big and too heavy to fly. Starts roaming around on the at night on the forest floor. But there's a whole lot of weird ecological niches for birds in New Zealand, like kiwi. Ground-dwelling insectivore isn't a really common bird niche. We've also had moa. Now, they may or may not be related to emu and rhea and cassowary and ostrich and elephant bird. Although, there's something to say that all those things exist in the southern hemisphere and all those parts of the world were all stuck together at one point. But we'll discuss it a wee bit more a little bit later on. So, the coming to a new place and having a whole lot of ecological niches to exploit and then doing it, different selection pressures, ending up with different species, is called adaptive radiation. So adaptive radiation is evidenced by a whole lot of different species arising at a very similar time period. And in New Zealand, that happened quite a lot. New Zealand broke away from Gondwana, from Proto-Australia. And then New Zealand's also been really affected by ice ages. We've got a lot of coastline. Very few places in New Zealand are very far from the coast. And so when sea levels rise, New Zealand's been underwater. When sea levels go down, more of New Zealand's been above water. And what that's done with our big, heavy mountains up the middle of the South Island means that when sea levels rise, little pockets of populations get separated. And especially if you're not very mobile, like if you're a lizard, you know, 10 or 15 centimetres long, you end up being isolated from all the other lizards, not being able to go visit the relatives, go and, you know, share your genes around in a big area. All of a sudden you're in a very small area and the selection pressures are very specific. That means we've had a whole lot of adaptive radiation of stuff like New Zealand geckos. Geckos have got a whole lot of niches up and down New Zealand. We've got skinks around Otago. Otago's, central Otago skinks just had its own protected area set aside for it, even though we now don't pay for plastic supermarket bags again, but that was the, in Dunedin, paying 5 cents for plastic supermarket bags was developing an area for the central Otago skink. Okay, so, gene pool, allele frequency, selection pressures acting on it, causing new species. If there's lots of space for the new species, there's a thing called adaptive radiation. And if we follow that adaptive radiation thing along some more, there was a common ancestor that suddenly became a whole lot of different things. Now, you may not have noticed roaming around the school, but our school, we've deliberately started planting what are very common landscape plants in New Zealand called hebes. Hebes come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, but they've got a really particular leaf morphology, which means they're opposite. Every successive leaves exist in pairs on the stem, and every successive pair of leaves is at 90 degrees to the other. But hebes have leaves that are so small that you almost can't see them because they're in a thing called a rat's tail, to leaves that are about 100 centimetres long. But they show that they've got a whole lot of ancestral things together. Their flowers are the same. They show a classic New Zealand thing of the flowers not being really brightly coloured. The most brightly coloured we get is the thing called New Zealand lilac. Sort of purpley. Okay, yellow flowers or yellow leaves. Now, the big tree with the yellow bits isn't the hebe, so that's okay. It's kauai. Or kauwhai, depending on your dialect. So hebes are mostly, they're brush, landscapey plants. Big trees are all live near rivers and we can keep carrying on. That's true. We don't have many bright coloured flowers. We have a couple. We do have some yellow ones. That's true too. Okay, so adaptive radiation. One thing turning into lots of things. If we looked at that as a pattern, if it's evolution happening, we call that divergent evolution. So adaptive radiation is a form of divergent evolution. One common ancestor and a number of different forms resulting from that ancestor, from different selection pressures and stuff. So if we've got divergent evolution, for the sake of defining things, we should also have convergent evolution, where things start off really different and evolve similarly. That's a nature thing saying, okay, if the best solution to any one problem might well be the same thing. Convergent evolution, the classic examples are referred to as like the shapes of sharks and dolphins and a dinosaur. Ichthyosaurs turned up in the same shape. But even, you know, other aquatic mammals, seals, end up, like, there is a solution which involves being living in the ocean. And if you're air-breathing and living in the ocean, that solution means, you know, spending a lot of time underwater and coming up to breathe. But all those ocean-dwelling things share a shape, as in fact do penguins. So, often there's only one solution and they keep coming towards that kind of thing. Then there's one called parallel evolution. Now, parallel evolution is where there's similar selection pressures in an area, or in different areas, and you end up again with a similar looking solution. And the best example is the one I used before, which is the big birds. Rhea, ostrich, elephant bird, emu, cassowary, moa. And in New Zealand, lots of species of moa suggest again, big bird turned up, and then what happens? Lots of potentially available ecological niches. Adaptive radiation leads then to speciation, and we've got the, you know, the giant moa, the 3 meter tall thing, going down in size down to the little sort of knee high things that go zooming through the bush. But the big birds don't appear to have had a common ancestor. That's recent stuff. Most of the books you read will suggest that they did have a common ancestor and that they are spread across because they were separated by continental drift. It appears that there have been a similar series of situations that have happened which have meant that that niche of large flightless bird has been advantaged in each place. Now, New Zealand is really obvious. Australia is pretty obvious. Lack of large carnivores means that giantism in birds has been a reasonably good solution. You get to survive as the big herbivore. In New Zealand, you're not in competition with cattle, antelope, kangaroos, all the other big herbivores. In Australia, they are. So emus deal with it by living a slightly different sort of lifestyle. Cassowaries, living in the jungle. Elephant birds, I don't know, lived on Madagascar. They've only found fossils of them. Ostriches obviously survive really well in that habitat because they are really, really well adapted to it. Rheas in South America have done the same sort of thing. That's called parallel evolution. Okay, last thing. And the problem with the last thing is that in some ways it's got to do with the history of where evolution came from. And that is that evolution started off it started off appearing to be in opposition to organized religion. one of the problems with that is that some people have accepted that evolution is religion, and so there's a sort of religious devotion to that, and we go right to the other side and say, and creationism is one of the other things that scraps against that. But how did all this sort of evolution happen over time? Like, it's easy to see evolution on a small scale. In a small scale in New Zealand, we're seeing a whole result of evolution in small things that reproduce really fast. Bacteria. You get a bacterial infection, you take antibiotics. Antibiotics kill 99.99% of them. And so what you're doing is applying a really strong selection pressure on bacteria, and only the only ones that survive are the ones that are resistant to the antibiotics. And so if you don't use the antibiotics well, if you only use the same type, if the people taking them don't take the whole course, if you take antibiotics because when you don't have an infection, you can kill off any bugs that are susceptible to that and leave all the other ones behind in a happy, nice-to-breed environment, and you breed. And what do we see in New Zealand? Superbugs. If you want to get us, if you want to get your own room in Dunedin Hospital, what do you have to do? Say, I've been to Europe in the last month because big places like the United States and Europe have more superbugs than New Zealand. We've seen the development of a virus which appears to be peculiarly adapted to New Zealand hospitals called norovirus. Norovirus seem to be really, really good at breeding in hospitals and rest homes and not really breeding anywhere else. But if you look up New Zealand hospitals, there's at least three major superbugs that are affecting different hospitals in New Zealand. And superbugs are called things like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, vancomycin-resistant. Okay, they've got resistance to most serious antibiotics, and that's evolution in action. Viruses are the same. I mean, why do we get flu every year or two? Mostly because our immune system gets used to flu, and flu is not very good at making copies of itself. In fact, it's really, really bad at making copies of itself. But it changes itself because it's actually bad at reproducing itself accurately. I think DNA polymerase makes about 1,000 times more errors than ours does. And if you multiply that by the number of viruses that exist in a human body at any one time, that error rate, even if 999 of them die, there's only one that has to survive and seriously infect things and have all the luck on its side as well to start producing a strain that's been recombined. And if your immune system doesn't kill it, all of a sudden you've developed a new thing. So your immune system's a selective pressure on bugs. Bugs are a selective pressure on your immune system. Because if your immune system doesn't work and technology doesn't work, you die for a genetic reason. Your immune system didn't kill that bug. So we need a grand theory of evolution as well. How do we start from that first molecule and end up as a rocket scientist? Or if any of you are going to be rocket scientists, how do we get from the primordial ooze, as it's called, to the highly evolved creatures we see around us today? And highly evolved is really only talking about the amount of complexity that we've got. And so, selection pressures, changes in the gene pool and randomness, but also we needed to explain what we see in the fossil record. And the fossil record goes back millions and millions of years. Do things continually change over time in little gradual steps, or is everything okay and then things get really hard and lots of things change at once and then everything's okay and then lots of things change at once? So those are the two theories. Gradual change, guess what that's called? Gradualism. And everything's the same, and then there's lots of change, and everything's the same, at equilibrium, in fact, and then there's lots of change. It's called punctuated equilibrium. So, two main theories. Gradualism, punctuated equilibrium. We're starting from the holy grail in parts of biology, which is what actually is the start of life? What makes things alive? The last universal common ancestor, So Luca's the thing in biology, last universal common ancestor. And we try and find what that might be. But also, that we look in terms of DNA about how much similarity we've got. And go, okay, well, there's been lots of change over time. So, there's evidence for each kind of theory, but those are the two main ones. It appears that punctuated equilibrium is the most likely one. Because what we have in the fossil record is stuff like, some things stay the same for ages. And then we get a whole lot of things like what's called the Cambrian explosion. A whole lot of life happened in the Cambrian period, and we get major extinctions happening as well. We get the extinction of the dinosaurs, the radiation of mammals. The other adaptive radiation one. How come all of Australia's mammals are marsupials, and there's almost none anywhere else? Okay, so it's adaptive radiation, and it's the time of separation, the same as New Zealand. New Zealand separated before mammals arrived, so we got dinosaurs and no big vertebrates. Australia separated from the rest of the world after mammals rose, but before placental mammals had arisen. So everything happened that was marsupials in Australia. You have a kind of animal that survives really well. You offer a whole range of ecological niches. And we get the word, which is adaptive radiation. And so marsupials filled all available niches from the marsupial lion down to marsupial mice. Almost everything you can think of in placental mammals had a marsupial analogue, except the platypus and the echidna. No, the echidna does, but the platypus doesn't. The first people who saw skeletons and skins of the platypus thought that someone was playing a joke on them. Because it's like really, really weird. So, basic principle, evolution, allele frequency in a population changes because of selection pressures. That can lead to reproductively separate populations. If they stay separate for long enough and the pressures stay on them, they end up as different species. Different species can't reproduce with each other. They then carry on and do those kind of things, and they continue to evolve. Often they evolve in that sort of convergent evolution, adaptive radiation. Every time there's a new environment, we get adaptive radiation into all the available niches. Sometimes they evolve convergently because they're trying to solve the same problem, like living in the water. They do this in one of two ways, either gradual change or what's called punctuated equilibrium. Lots of periods of stasis, then major change, then stasis, or maybe there's a theory somewhere in the middle of those two. There's a sort of level of change, then there's a lot, then there's a bit more change, then there's lots. It's really hard to prove. So, that.